Intruder alert, intruder alert.
Welcome aboard, Captain. Fighter pilots needed in Sector Wars. Play Astro Blaster.
R2 joint increase of power.
Yahoo!
You're all clear, kid.
Friends, thank you for taking the time out of your busy holiday schedule to join us once again for the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast. I'm your host, Vic Sage, and for this show, I was going to originally be talking about the classic multi-directional shooter from 1980, Stern Electronics' Berserk, a game I encountered at the first arcade of my youth. Games people play. The reason I won't be tackling that fantastic game, however, is that while recording the episode, I happened to stumble upon the fact that I had already covered Berserk in an earlier episode of the podcast, episode 14, in fact.
Intruder alert. Gotcha, humanoid. Gotcha, intruder.
So, while I hated that I was a good way through the recording and had to delete that work, I'm glad I discovered it before I had it uploaded. So instead, I'm going to be discussing another arcade classic from 1980, a space-themed multi-directional shooter produced by Cinematronics. I'm talking about Star Castle. Now, Star Castle was designed by Tim Skelly. But before we get to him, we kind of need to dive into the history of Cinematronics, and in particular, Larry Rosenthal. So bear with me as this intro might be a little more information heavy than what I normally share with you all. And I hope you will bear with me during this podcast because, as you probably can tell from my voice, I'm actually sick. I was aware of Cinematronics thanks to their producing Dragon's Lair in 1983. But the company was actually founded back in 1975 in El Cajon, California. The trio of founders were Gary Garrison, Dennis Partey, and Jimmy Pyrrhus. Although I've read that both Dennis and Gary ended up selling their portion of stock in the company to Tom Stroud, apparently a longtime businessman in pinball and other coin-operated games. Before selling their stock to Stroud, the trio had produced, like so many other early developers of video games in the day, a copy of Pong. In addition, they purchased the rights to manufacture a game in 1976 called Flipper Ball, which, thanks to the Killer List of Video Games site, appears to have been a sort of video pinball with a little mix of Breakout. Players controlled a horizontal paddle to attempt to clear 16 square bumpers on the screen and hit a moving target without the ball bouncing into one of the pocket areas. After Gary and Dennis had left Cinematronics is when Larry Rosenthal enters the picture. Rosenthal was an MIT graduate that was so blown away by 1961's Space War that his master thesis was about the computer game. And he also managed to produce the hardware that could be built affordably using a TTL processor. TTL stands for Transistor Logic. And this hardware wasn't raster-based, but used vector beams to create the graphics. Apparently, the designer was able to code the hardware to a 16-button keyboard, and I've read that it all fit into a suitcase. Rosenthal partnered with Cinematronics after obtaining a license from MIT to create an arcade game version of Space War. However, the designer needed to find a company that could produce the arcade cabinets. Rosenthal, in 1977, took that very suitcase around to various companies, including Atari, but had no luck, until Cinematronics agreed to produce the cabinets. Here's the thing, though. As per their agreement, Rosenthal would not only keep the rights to the game, which Cinematronics called Space Wars, but would in addition get 50% of the profits for every cabinet sold, which seems to have been quite a bit of money, if what Tim Skelly, the designer for 1980 Star Castle, has said is true, stating in an interview in 1999 that Cinematronics sold 30,000 units of the game for $2,000 apiece. Space Wars apparently did very well, and for what it might be worth, I certainly remember playing it at a local bowling alley when I was a kid. Back then, and even today, I think there's just something captivating about vector graphics games. I mean, look at 1979's Asteroids, or 1983's Star Wars. They managed to draw the player's eye when walking through an arcade. So, as I was saying, Space Wars was doing quite well for Cinematronics and, naturally, Larry Rosenthal in 1978. And this is when Tim Skelly came in for an interview for the opportunity to work at the company. After a meeting with Pyrrhus, he was asked to go and chat with Rosenthal in the tech area. As I've read online, Skelly found Larry to be evasive and had assumed that his job interview was something of a disaster, to only find he had secured the job when he returned home to Kansas City. In that same 1999 interview, which I will be sure to include the link to in the article post on the Pop Culture Retrorama site for this episode, Tim mentions that after driving 4 days to put down stakes in El Cajon, California, when he arrived at Cinematronics, he was shown to what would be his office, which was in fact the tech area he had met Rosenthal in. Except now, instead of equipment like Rosenthal's keyboard and his suitcase system, there was office furniture and a yellow legal pad and pencil. You see, when he wasn't given more money, Rosenthal left Cinematronics and started up his own company called Vector Beam. At Vector Beam, Rosenthal would produce their own Space War cabinets. Space War, minus the S now. And also, he would design and produce Speed Freak, a vector graphics racing game, releasing it in March of 79. In addition, Larry would end up purchasing the vector graphics maze title, Barrier, from Cinematronics, releasing the game to the arcades in August of 1979. Sadly, the latter maze game wasn't well received by the public, and it would lead to Rosenthal selling Vector Beam, which included his Vector game patents, to Cinematronics later that year, which sounds like it was a boon to both Cinematronics and to Skelly. As I understand it, Cinematronics, after Rosenthal left, could still produce Space War games, paying Larry per their contract, but without any of the equipment, and for some reason, no documentation was made for said equipment. The techs at Cinematronics had to reverse engineer Rosenthal's work. Now, it appears that Pyrrhus and Stroud allowed Vector Beam to keep running as a sister company for a very short time. The first title for Cinematronics that Tim Skelly designed as well as programmed was Starhawk. This was in 1979, and this is a title I've mentioned before in my Saturday Frights podcast. Starhawk was most definitely based on the trench run moment of 1977 Star Wars. That same year, Skelly designed and programmed a rather rare puzzle vector graphics game called Sundance. Reading about it online, it sounds like the game was using the same printed circuit board as Space Wars. And from that interview from 1999, Skelly said, and I quote, "This required a daughter board and lots of cut and jumpering. As a result, this game was very fragile and few lived long." End quote. The next game that Tim Skelly designed and programmed yet again, that makes three titles in 1979 alone, was the vector graphics-based Medieval Knights fighting title, Warrior. This is a game I've wanted to play for a very long time. I've seen videos of it online and it just looks beautiful. Not sure how well it plays, but it does look neat. After Warrior was released is when Cinematronics shuttered Vector Beam. Then, in 1980, Skelly, yet again, designed and programmed the game Ripoff, a multi-directional shooter that happened to be the first of the genre to feature cooperative gameplay. Of course, also in 1980, was Star Castle. Now, Tim Skelly only designed Star Castle. It was programmed by Scott Bowden of Solar Quest fame. Afterwards, Skelly would go on to create some very memorable and classic arcade titles after the success of Star Castle, such as 1982's arcade hit Reactor for Gottlieb. You know, the very game that I use as the music for the opening of the show? Tim would also work on the software and hardware design for the first BattleTech Center, located in the North Pier Mall in Chicago. He even worked on some of the designs of the mechs in the game. And last but not least, Skelly also served as an art director and game design advisor for Sega's Sonic the Hedgehog 2, which was originally released in 1992. Whew, like I said, that was an incredible amount of history involving Larry Rosenthal as well as Tim Skelly. It's just that with Rosenthal giving us the first vector graphic titles, although obviously they would not be the last, he deserved a little bit of the spotlight. The same with Tim Skelly, thanks to his incredible contribution to the early days of gaming. As I've mentioned many times on this podcast, my father was not a fan of video games, to say the least. Back in the day, he would occasionally give Pac-Man or Donkey Kong a shot, but in truth, even though he supported and understood why I loved video games, he kind of saw it as a colossal waste of money and time. With Star Castle, though, lo and behold, here was a video game that my father was totally captivated by. Not at that fabled Showbiz Pizza of my youth, but at the Games People Play arcade. To be fair, I liked it too, but found it to be too difficult to be any good at. Granted, I was like 9 when it hit our neck of the woods. But my father had finally found a game that he was good at, and that he actually looked forward to playing. That all came to an end, however, one Saturday afternoon. To be honest, my father was racking up a really high score on the game, like enough to draw attention from other players. If you played Star Castle for yourself, you know the gameplay can get a little tense in later stages, when everything starts to speed up. Plus, there was that droning sound effect that would speed up the closer the player was to exposing the cannon within the Star Castle. My father kept racking up the points, dodging the enemy mines, and clearing stage after stage, earning extra lives. This probably went on for a good 5 minutes. What I'm saying is, my father was totally, and for the first time in a video game, in the zone. Obviously, we all know the game will win in the end, but my father was giving it his all. I can recall he was actually sweating while playing this game of Star Castle. He reached his last man, and to my father's point of view, the game took him out with a cheap shot. The space cannon in the center of the Star Castle blasted him out of existence before he had a chance to react. There were 5 teenagers who had been watching him rack up this high score, and they, like myself, let out a groan of disappointment. My father placed his hands on the marquee and shoved the Star Castle arcade cabinet in a fit of anger. And it actually tilted backwards. It would have fallen all the way back and been damaged if or not the way that Games People Play situated their cabinets. Within the arcade, they had 4 islands of arcade cabinets in small circles, 5 cabinets in total for each island. So, I watched in horror as Star Castle tilted back, managed to come in contact with the 2 games beside it, which halted its fall, allowing my father to come to his senses and help ease the game back in place. 2 things happened after that. The teenagers immediately found other games to play in the arcade, and my father stormed out. He ended up sitting in the car in the parking lot for a very long time before coming back in, and he never really played another video game again. Now, flash forward to a couple years back, and as you can imagine, when Shay was able to purchase a cocktail version of Star Castle for the arcade, you can understand why I made sure that on a day off, that I brought my father with me. As we were walking through the arcade, he heard that droning hum and stopped dead in his tracks. And when I led him to the game, just for the briefest of moments, he almost sat down to play it. But then, I'm sure the memory of how Star Castle had worked him up in the past caused him to reconsider, and he walked away. Star Castle tasks 1 to 2 players, taking alternate turns, to pilot a starship tasked with destroying a mighty space cannon that is situated dead center in the middle of the screen, protected by 3 rotating energy rings, or walls, of the Star Castle. The game controls are set up a little like Atari's Asteroids. 2 buttons allow a player to either rotate their ship to the left or right, and a thrust button is provided so you can move the ship around the screen. Yet again, like Asteroids, a player can wrap around to the other side of the screen. So, if you're in the far right of the screen and thrust in that direction, you will appear on the left-hand side. Fly to the very top, and you will appear on the bottom of the screen, etc. There is a fire button for the player to defend themselves with, and needed to destroy those rotating walls that protect the cannon. Only 4 shots can be on the screen at one time. It takes 2 shots to destroy 1 of the 12 sections that make up a ring of rotating walls. The walls naturally rotate at varying speeds. Having blasted an opening in the outer wall, you can wait for it to rotate back again, or just keep blasting the segments away. However, if you do manage to completely destroy the outer wall, the middle ring expands to take the place of the outer ring, and a new ring of walls becomes the innermost ring of defenses for the space cannon. So, it's better to just clear away enough of the first 2 ring of walls to get a chance to hurl a shot at the space cannon before it's able to fire off its incredibly loud and fast-moving, and practically impossible to avoid, death bolt at you. Now, the space cannon will not fire off a shot at the player until the rotating ring of walls allows it a clear shot through an opening. So what I'm saying is, it's not going to shoot through the walls to cost you a life. A player can, after clearing out a bit of the first two rings, fire off three shots at the innermost ring of walls. The two shots destroy the barrier, and the third takes out the space cannon before it can power up and fire. Now, I did say the fire button was there for a player to defend themselves because the Star Castle employs space mines to protect itself. Three, in fact, that once released from the walls, will try to head towards and blow up the player's ship. A mine can be freed by either blasting a segment of the wall it is attached to, or if the mines reach the outer ring of walls, they can detach on their own and come after you. These mines are small, though, and especially after playing the game for a bit, are incredibly fast. As you will receive no points for shooting one, it's best to try and fly away from them. And the mines, nor the space cannon shot, can use the wraparound effect of the screen. A player can reattach a mine to a wall if they're flying close enough that the mine comes in contact with one of the remaining rotating segments. In fact, a player's ship will just bounce off a ring wall if it comes in contact with it. By the way, I've read that it isn't how many space cannons you obliterate or how high you're racking up that score that determines the speed of the enemies. It's all time-based. The longer it takes for the player to destroy the cannon, the quicker the game becomes. On the killer list of video games, I've read that for every 182,000 points a player earns, the game will slow down. I assume that means it will revert back to the speed at the starting of the game. Speaking of score, for each of the 12 segments of the outermost ring of walls a player destroys, they will earn 10 points. 20 points for each segment of the middle ring, and 30 points for each segment of the innermost ring of walls. Wiping out all the sections of the walls will earn a player 720 points. Of course, remember that you would want to save the last segment of the outer wall for the last because of the regeneration of the ring wall effect I talked about a moment ago. For taking out the space cannon, you will earn points for all the remaining wall segments as the Star Castle collapses in on itself. Plus, you will get an extra man. Every single time you take the cannon out, you earn another ship. Of course, you already have realized that with all those segments blasted away, the space cannon is just going to be tracking you and hurling those deadly bolts at the player's ship. And friends, that really is the gist of Star Castle. A simple enough game to understand, but an incredibly hard title to master. The world record holder on Star Castle is John P. McAllister, who holds the record for both easy and hardship settings. I am sorry, but I do not know the exact differences between the game modes. I'm just assuming that the hardship will mean the space cannon tracks the player quicker and the mines are faster, etc. At the Arcadia Retrocade, well, the Star Castle cocktail cabinet is in the second wing, so it's not available to the players as of yet. I'm going to go ahead, however, and say that John Munkus is the high score holder for the game. Star Castle received an LCD handheld version of the game, courtesy of Tiger Electronics in 1982, as well as an excellent port to the Vectrex home console in 1983. Interestingly enough, I've read that in 2012, during a live stream of that particular port of the game, a player by the name of Vector Gamer earned 1,005,310 points.
And now, these messages.
This is an ordinary TV video game. This is Vectrex, the only video game system with its own video screen. Take it anywhere. Just plug it in. It's your own personal arcade. A high-performance system with a built-in game plus a whole collection of arcade cartridges like Scramble, Pole Position, Berserk. So if you're into video games, forget the TV. Get into Vectrex. Light pen and 3D imager available.
You're a fly named Yar on a quest in space. You attack the shield of the Kotile's base, but watch out, Yar.
He knows where you are. Yar's revenge is right on Atari. Have you played Atari today?
With ion zones and evil drones, there's nothing else like Yar's revenge, the way out space game that's new from Atari. Who else?
Have you played Atari today?
Now, most of you probably already know this, but Yar's Revenge, which was designed and programmed by the truly legendary Howard Scott Warshaw, was originally intended to be an Atari 2600 port of Star Castle. Warshaw, however, felt that the limitations with the 2600 wouldn't provide a worthy port of the arcade title. So, instead, he reworked it, and Yar's Revenge would end up becoming Atari's highest-selling cartridge. Although, having said that, in 2012, there was a Kickstarter started by D. Scott Williamson, a former Atari employee himself, who finally brought StarCastle to the 2600 by way of an 8K cartridge. Another fun fact is that StarCastle has managed to pop up in various movies and television shows. It shows up in 1982's Fast Times at Ridgemont High and Rocky III. It was in 1983's Joysticks, 1984's Ghostbusters, and 1986's Maximum Overdrive. In fact, while StarCastle managed to make my father rage out back in the day, in the Stephen King-directed film, a StarCastle machine manages to kill a patron of the Dixie Boy truck stop. Not just anyone either. That unlucky patron who crossed the wrong video game was none other than Breaking Bad and The Mandalorian's Giancarlo Esposito. And last but not least, StarCastle also appeared in a 1989 episode of Columbo entitled Murder, Smoke, and Shadows. Right next to it, you can also see a Joust arcade cabinet. And friends, I think that about wraps up what I have to say about 1980s StarCastle. As always, I want to thank you again for taking the time to listen to the show. I'm no expert, just a fan of classic arcade and home console games, and enjoy talking about them. As this is New Year's Eve, I want to wish you a very safe and happy holiday. In addition, I want to thank Walter R., who really came through for the arcade this year. You see, for the last 8 New Year's Eve celebrations at the Arcadia Retrocade, I have been able to purchase vintage 1980s Great Blue Dini Kool-Aid. In my youth, I loved it because after mixing it up, it resembled the Pure Source liquid that was featured in Walt Disney's Tron. Now, it looked like this year, this was not going to be the case. The prices for a single packet were getting too high. Sure, I could have picked up some of the new Blue Dini that was released a couple of years ago, but the joy is being able to share in something that was available when most of the games we have at the arcade were brand new. Anyway, to make a long story short, it turns out that Walter, who lives in Houston, Texas, is a fan of the show, and he overnighted the packets to me at no additional charge. So, for everyone that is attending the New Year's Eve party at the arcade tonight, the first cup of Great Blue Dini will be raised to Walter R. The Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast is available on iTunes, and I'm working on trying to rebuild the podcast library, a result of switching from the Retroist site to the Pop Culture Retrorama one. You can check out daily posts by myself and others by visiting www.popculturetrorama.com. The podcast is available on Google Podcasts as well as Spotify. No matter how you listen to the show, if you have a moment and enjoy the podcast, why not give us a rating and review to help us find new listeners? You can find out more about the Arcadia Retrocade by visiting Facebook. Or if you need daily posts, you can check out the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast Facebook page. I share all manner of vintage arcade and home console fun multiple times a day. If you have any feedback or comments about the podcast, you can always reach me on Facebook or throw me an email at vicsagepopculture@gmail.com. You also can often find me posting videos of the arcade on my Instagram account, which is simply vicsage_. As always, I want to thank The Retroist. For over a decade, The Retroist provided a spot on the internet where fans of all things retro could visit and enjoy the best retro-related articles and podcasts. I certainly wouldn't have my own site or multiple podcasts without The Retroist's support. The Retroist site is back in operation, and he's producing new podcasts. This has been a Pop Culture Retrorama podcast. Goodbye, and thanks for listening. The Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast is not affiliated with or authorized by Cinematronics, Vectorbeam, Atari, or any of the businesses and individuals that have been mentioned in the show. All music and sound clips from the mentioned video games and commercials are the property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. Audio clips are included for the purpose of review, criticism, and commentary only, and are not intended to infringe.
End of line.